on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
I think Rey always saw himself as an ambassador for witchcraft. And remember, to him, witchcraft was very much a religion, and he wanted it treated seriously as a religion. There are a couple of things. He has an unpublished memoir, which helped me write this book. And there are a couple of moments in the memoir where he makes fun of people who don't dress like average, everyday people, right? He thought, as a public spokesperson for witchcraft, that he should wear a suit to interviews, and he should try to present himself as mainstream as possible, because that's what he wanted. He wanted a seat at the table for witchcraft. The problem is, though, is like once you identify as a witch, I don't care how well you dress, how stylish your suit is, no one's looking at it. All they're hearing is the word witch, right? So by the 1980s, he did run into some trouble in places. He had a couple of speeches that were canceled. This was the era of satanic panic. And having a witch speak at a YMCA, oh, how terrible, right? Like, they're corrupting the children. And that was a big change from the late 60s through the mid to late 70s, where the occult was kind of in vogue, right? You could go on Tom Snyder's Tomorrow Show, on go on Dick Cavett, and people were just sort of enchanted by you, right? Yeah. Oh, you're a witch. Tell me what's that like? Yeah. Which is really different from in the mid-80s going on Sally Jesse Raphael and being yelled at by the audience because they think that you're a Satan worshiper or something.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Jason Mankeet to discuss his book, High Priest, Raymond Buckland, the Father of American Witchcraft. Jason discusses Buckland's pivotal role in introducing Wicca to the United States in the 1960s, his influence on the growth of witchcraft through public speaking, writing, including the iconic Big Blue Book, media appearances, and his efforts to make witchcraft inclusive and accessible and establishing witchcraft communities across North America. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Jason Mankeet is a third-degree Gardnerian high priest and helps run two witchcraft covens in the San Francisco Bay Area with his wife, Ari. He is a popular speaker at pagan and witchcraft events across North America and Great Britain and has been recognized by his peers as an authority on the Horned God, Wiccan history, and occult influences in rock and roll. He is the author of several books, including The Witch's Book of Spellcraft, The Horned God of the Witches, and Transformative Witchcraft. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, High Priest, Raymond Buckland, the Father of American Witchcraft. Jason, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thanks for having me, Nick. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I've had a few... I don't know if they actually identified as Wiccans or even if they identified as witches, but I've had a few pagans on here and I saw that you wrote this book and I was really interested because when I was much younger, I hung out with a couple of Wiccan covens and I really didn't know much about Raymond Buckland except, and this is probably where most people know about Raymond Buckland, is the Big Blue Book.
Absolutely. That is the same copy I have, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, and this was not even the original. I was lent a copy very early on back in the late 80s, and it must have only been like a year or two after he had published it. And I had to give that one back. So I thought, well, you know, I should have a copy of this. This is an important book to have. Even if I don't practice Wicca, I still feel as a religious studies scholar that it's an important book to have. So with all of that said, I thought that maybe the best place to begin is with who was Raymond Buckland? And that's going to be, I think, most of the conversation. But for anyone in my audience who is unfamiliar with Buckland, how would you answer that question?
So the subtitle of the book is The Father of American Witchcraft. And I think that does a pretty good job of summarizing Raymond Buckland. It is a very big statement, but Raymond was one of the first public witches in the United States. He is not a United States native. He actually came over from the UK with his family in 1962, and in 1963 he was initiated into witchcraft. And this is a very different world in 1963 versus 2025, or even 1995. So back then, if you wanted to be a witch and self-identify that way, you had two choices. You could either make everything up yourself, and people would still roll their eyes at you in certain circles, or you could be initiated into witchcraft. And Raymond Buckland was initiated into witchcraft. That witchcraft group started in the late 40s, early 50s. There is some debate about the timeline by an Englishman named Gerald Gardner, and today we call that Gardnerian Wicca, though practitioners identified as witches for a very long time and not necessarily Wiccans. So he brings Gardnerian witchcraft to the United States in 1963 and forms really what I think is the first coven in North America that we can truly verify that there's a real paper trail. I'm sure that there were ones before Buckland's. But again, there is no definitive evidence that there was. It's just likely. So he forms a witchcraft coven in 64. By 65, of course, he's in newspapers talking about witchcraft and how people can come to witchcraft. And then in the early 1970s, he leaves the Gardnerian tradition and he starts his own tradition called CX Wicca, which equates dedication as the same as initiation. So now all of a sudden, you don't have to be initiated to be a witch. Here is a witchcraft tradition that anyone can do. And that came out in a book called The Tree, the complete book of Saxon witchcraft, which is not very complete, and there's really not very much that's Saxon about it, but it's still a really important book. So, if Ray had only done those two things, I think people would still be talking about him today. But in 1986, he releases The Big Blue Book, which I would say is the most recognizable witchcraft book of the modern era. It's a giant blue book with a pentagram on the cover, and it's never changed. All the other books of that era have new covers. Ray's book always looked the same, even the 25th anniversary edition, blue pentagram. Everybody knows what it is. And then he had a kind of a weird second act. He became a very active spiritualist. In the mid 90s, he publishes a book called Doors to Other Worlds, which is about communicating with the dead. In the early 2000s, that book is sort of reimagined as Buckland's complete book of spirit communications. And if you're talking to some groups of people, they might talk about the big red book instead of the big blue book. So those were the kind of some of the big things that Buckland did. But as I said, just bringing Gardnerian Wicca to the United States in 1963, 1964 was a really big deal, and he opened the door for a lot of people to practice as witches.
Okay, wonderful. So we're going to dig into some of that, but I think that maybe before it might be helpful to talk just a little bit about Wicca and witchcraft and Gerald Gardner in general, kind of the history that Buckland kind of enters into and then brings to the US and sort of transforms it. So let's start with, I think most people are a little bit familiar with Wicca, and they're probably familiar with the idea of connecting Wicca and witchcraft together. But maybe we can just talk a little bit about that and Gerald Gardner.
So Gerald Gardner comes forward in 1951 in London, England, and he says, "I'm a practicing witch. That's my religion." And for him and people like Buckland very early on, witchcraft was definitely seen as a religion. And that was a pretty big deal because no one before that had ever really said, "Hi, I'm a witch and this is my religion." Maybe they said, "Hi, I'm a white witch. I practice magic to overcome negative spells or something." But no one had ever really identified as a witch and that witchcraft was their religion. According to Gerald Gardner, he was initiated in 1939 in an area of England known as the New Forest. He doesn't really talk about that coven a lot. He wrote a couple of books. One of them was a biography called Gerald Gardner Witch, which is really his story, though it's attributed to a different writer. And he had really a lot of say in how it was put together. But he doesn't say a whole lot about that coven. He says they did one major ritual, which we call Operation Cone of Power, which was to stop Hitler from invading the UK. And I just would like to point out that Hitler never invaded the UK, so perhaps witchcraft is to thank for that. After the war, he gets involved in a lot of other things, a lot of other sort of esoteric religious orders. And then in the late 40s, he kind of comes back to witchcraft. He publishes a book called High Magic's Aid, which is a fictional account of his version of witchcraft. And then in 1954, he publishes the book Witchcraft Today. And Gardner at this point is very active in the press. He does a lot of newspapers, magazines, et cetera, and he brings a lot of people into witchcraft. And again, this is something that you can only be initiated into. If you read Witchcraft Today looking to be a witch, you'd be very disappointed. It's a terrible book. There's not a whole lot of witchcraft ritual in the book. It's mostly a lot of history that is inaccurate, but it was a starting point. Gerald also owned a museum about witchcraft and magic on the Isle of Man, which is how Buckland got a hold of him. Because he owned this museum, he was very easy to contact. You just sent a letter to the museum. So it was kind of like a lodestone for anyone looking for witchcraft. Gardner dies in 1964. He was a very old man by this point, very frail, not in the best of health, and he used to try to get away from England during the winters. And he died on a boat outside of Tunisia, where he's buried today. But Gerald Gardner is really sort of the architect of what we might call Wiccan witchcraft today, or Wicca. He never used the term Wicca with two C's. He talked about the Wicca, kind of a term that means the wise ones, people who practiced witchcraft. And yeah, he's really responsible for the witchcraft revival. I think it would still be here without Gardner, but in a very diminished form.
Okay. And so one of the things that came to mind, I don't know, and I don't know if you'll know or not, but wasn't it in 1950s in the UK, wasn't witchcraft still considered like illegal?
There was an act that was passed in 1951 which made witchcraft legal for all intents
Okay.
and purposes.
All
There had
right.
been a law before that, and the law was really directed at people who told fortunes and spiritualists, is what the law was really directed at. And they used witchcraft as a term to mean anything that was sort of magical. I don't think in 1935, if you told people you practiced witchcraft, that you were going to go to jail. But it was like a really good PR thing to come out in 1951 after this was passed. I think it was called the Fraudulent Mediums Act, which was really what they were trying to stop, right? But if you wanted to be a witch, that was a whole other thing.
Okay. Well, and what is a witch according to Gardnerian witchcraft? I mean, what is the just like a summary, and I know it's difficult to do, but just kind of a summary of what a practicing witch does.
If you were to ask somebody like Gardner or Buckland in 63, 64, they would say it was an initiated person is a witch, and that you really can't be a witch without an initiation. I think today the term witch is used in a lot of different ways. It's used as a term of women's empowerment, and it's been used that way really since the beginning of the 20th century. A lot of times people use it to mean any sort of magical practice. Like, my grandma used to do spells to get rid of warts. Clearly, she was a witch, but she also went to Baptist church. So it's very different from a witch like Buckland or Gardner, who said, "This is my religion." Of course, Wiccans and witches have been kind of pushed together for a long time, though there are a lot of people who get really angry when someone uses Wicca and witchcraft interchangeably. They're like, "Oh, they're so different." I'm like, yeah, context. I think most people can figure it out when we're talking about these things. So, witch is used in a lot of different ways. For a long time, witch basically meant magic user bad. And then that slowly began to change throughout the 20th century.
Okay. Yeah, the witchcraft now, I would say, is a very diverse kind of phenomenon. There's all these different
avenues and approaches to it, and it's quite fascinating. And yeah, so Gardner, excuse me, not Gardner, but Buckland, and what was some of his early, I guess, influences that might have led him to witchcraft? Because, you know, it's not something that a lot of people, especially at that time, would be like, hey, I think I want to be a witch. What were some of the things that kind of propelled him towards that path?
You know, while I was writing the book, I kept looking for the smoking gun, right? This is the thing that led me to witchcraft. I read this book and it opened these doors. And it's really not there, though he had a few interesting experiences as a young man. One of them was during a seance. So before he got into witchcraft, he and his wife, Rosemary, hosted seances in their apartment. And they're doing a seance once, and a spirit tells him that I am your brother. And he's like, my brother Gerard is very much alive. And, you know, there's no way this could be. He found out that his mom had miscarried early on. So he potentially had a brother. And no one in the family had ever told Ray this. He had to ask one of his uncles about it. And then he found out it was true. So to me, that's sort of a pretty big moment, that there are things outside of the mainstream, that you have this moment where you're doing a seance and the information that you find is so specific to you that it kind of blows your mind. And that might have been some of it. He was also not somebody who really clicked with Christianity during his time when he was in the Royal Air Force, because everybody back then was drafted, and so he had to serve in the Royal Air Force for a while. You were supposed to pick a religion, and he picked jazz, which did not go over well when people figured it out. They didn't like jokes, but he just never felt comfortable in organized religion. I think he was looking for something that was more sort of hands-on, that was more interactive than sitting in a church pew.
Yeah. And there was one point in the book early on, and this was when he was a kid, and this would have been during the war, you had commented that there was a tree that he would go and sit in, and that he had this connection to the tree. And it seemed to me that that also is a kind of an early seed, because so much of what we understand today as Wicca is connected to the earth and seeing it as a living being, I think. And so I thought that if he had that sort of kernel there, of course it would make sense that he would be attracted to a tradition that honored the earth.
It was a very pagan moment for him as a child, I think. I'm cradled in this tree. I'm looking at this beautiful expanse of England while I'm also terrified for my life at most moments because German bombers keep flying overhead. You know, it was that little bit of calm and peace. And yeah, I think that might have played a role in it too. You know, that connection to the earth.
All right.
Though I would say like early witchcraft materials do not play up that connection as much as we're used to it today. Okay. Like if you read Gerald Gardner's books, it's really more about the magic of things. And not so much a connection to the earth, which I think is something that really arose in the late 60s, early 70s because of hippies and things. Right. You know, Gardnerian witchcraft especially is a parlor religion because everyone's naked. And if you think of the weather in England, it is not a place that encourages you to be naked outside.
Well, today it is. It's almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So,
yeah,
the climate in England's changing a bit. Climate everywhere is changing a bit, but it's becoming, I have been told, it's becoming a little bit more Mediterranean.
Yeah, they make some good wine there now because it mimics France, what it was like 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so Raymond eventually came into contact with Gardner's books, or the two main books, and was that Witchcraft Today and the Meaning of Witchcraft, and that led him to send a letter to Gardner, and that's kind of what set him on this path. Now, I know that there was a bit of a question as to whether or not he actually ever met Gerald Gardner. He was not initiated by Gerald Gardner. He and his wife, Rosemary, were initiated by someone else, right?
So for all of his life, he said that he had a warm relationship with Gardner through letters.
Okay.
And when I saw the letters from that era, there are two from Gardner, and they're not particularly warm. They're more like, oh, you wrote me a letter. I will respond back poorly and quickly, right? That you can tell when someone likes you in a letter. You know, to Gardner, it felt like Buckland was just another person seeking witchcraft, and he didn't really have a relationship with him. So that's really different from the story that Buckland tells. You know, oh, we became pen pals, and then he put me in charge of correspondence with North American witches. And so I don't think that's probably true. However, he does end up with a good letter relationship with a woman named Monique Wilson, who is one of Gerald Gardner's high priestesses, and she's acting for Gerald Gardner. She doesn't do anything that Gardner doesn't know about. And she ends up with a pretty warm pen pal relationship with Ray, and then later his wife Rosemary. So you can tell that there's this change. Maybe Ray just got the names wrong, because wrote like Monique Wilson is later vilified in witch circles. We can talk about that later if you want, but she becomes kind of persona non grata by the end of the 60s, early 70s. So they're writing all these letters. Ray's like, I just desperately wish that I could celebrate a witch holiday so badly. And, you know, Monique's like, well, you have to come over here and you have to get initiated. You know, you and your wife need to come over here. You have to do this. At the time, Ray worked for British Airways, so he probably got a discount on travel. However, he had just come to the United States with his wife, and they had two small boys, so not a whole lot of extra spending money, even with a discount. But Ray figures out that he can go by himself if that is acceptable, and he does go by himself, probably on November 23rd, and he's initiated that night into witchcraft. Rosemary stays home with the boys, and then she's initiated by Ray when he comes home. One of the stories that Buckland liked to tell was that Gardner was at his initiation, and the correspondence argues against that. First of all, we know where Gardner was on November 23rd, and he was on the boat that he would die on in Tunisia a couple of months from then. The boat was actually still in port, but Gardner didn't drive on his own. Somebody would have had to drive him. That person would have been a witch, and they probably would have made mention of, I dropped Gerald off at Monique Wilson's house. So there's none of that. And then in the letters from Monique to Buckland and from Buckland to Monique, there's no mention that Gardner's going to be present at the initiation. And the subsequent letters make no mention of Gardner's presence at the initiation. And a few weeks after the initiation, and also Buckland is raised to the second and third degrees. It's kind of like Freemasonry. There are three tiers within initiatory witchcraft. Monique Wilson writes a letter to Gerald Gardner saying, hey, we just initiated Raymond Buckland. So if Gardner had been there doesn't seem to be a need for those things, right? So I don't think that Gardner was there. Can't prove it conclusively, but the evidence does not suggest as such. And again, it was just something that Buckland said over and over. Gerald was at my initiation. I thought he was a pleasant fellow. I think claiming Gardner is there was a way to sort of give his initiation a little extra bona fides, a little extra oomph, right? Oh, yeah. The guy who started this was there. Like, nobody can question this.
And that's not the only thing that he did. I mean, he sometimes early on would refer to himself as a doctor as well.
Yes. Yes. You know, he was not above a little, you know, self-embellishment. That was something that Gerald Gardner started, referring to himself as a doctor. It was common amongst English occultists to claim degrees they did not have. And when Gardner started writing, he didn't really write like, I'm a witch, even though he had said he was a witch in magazine articles. He wrote as an interested scholar, you know, like, I'm exploring the witches. I'm not one of the witches. And when Buckland started writing, he kind of did the same thing. And the idea of having a doctor or a PhD by your name lends that a little more authority and credibility. But the thing is, it's easily proven whether you're not you're a PhD or have a doctorate, and there's a paper trail, and the paper trail for neither of them leads them to a PhD until Ray bought one from the Universal Life Church. So by the end of his life, he could claim he was a PhD because he bought one for $29.99.
Yeah, is Universal Life Church still doing this? I signed up once. I have a certificate somewhere in storage that I'm a reverend, and I did that mostly to annoy someone I used to work
Yeah, I think they're still around.
with. Okay.
And Ray really liked them. You know, he
Yeah.
affiliated some of his things with the Universal Life Church
Yeah.
for the tax purposes of it and things. And
Sure.
I think he liked the idea that there was a group giving credentials to people
Yeah.
for free or for a small
Yeah.
amount of money.
Oh yeah. Yeah, mine was free, I think. I don't remember paying for it, but
Oh, I got a certificate so I could marry people, you know? Super easy.
Yeah, that was exactly it. I officiated a friend's wedding back in the day. And I mean, there's, separation between church and state in theory, and so no one can say otherwise, so why
Yeah.
not? So Ray and his wife Rosemary began this New York coven. And that is when all of this begins ex kind of, I don't want to say necessarily exploding, but that was the beginning of witchcraft in America. So, how did it begin growing from there? And what was Buckland's role? Because, I also want to bring in that he was writing. I mean, he had a day job. My
Yeah.
experience is pretty much most of the authors that I speak to have day jobs. So he had his day job, but he was writing all this material and leading a coven, and there was this growth from that. And so I was curious if you could speak to those sort of very early days of American witchcraft.
I think it's really fascinating that before he was initiated, he and Rosemary had a group of people meeting at their house who were interested in witchcraft. So when he came back to the United States, he basically had a coven ready to go, and he initiated two people that January. So all of a sudden, they're a coven of four right out of the gate. And this is a time when, if you really wanted to meet other witches, there were very few opportunities. You could write to Fate magazine. That was where a lot of people like tried to find other witches. I'm sure they lived in Long Island, so they were not too far from New York City. So there were probably opportunities to meet people in bookstores and things. And clearly they did because they had this group. And by April, they were a group of eight people. So the initiations came pretty quickly during that first year. Again, the problem is, how do people find out about witches? And in 1965, that's when the first newspaper articles that feature Ray and Rosemary hit. And they're Ray and Rosemary, but not Ray and Rosemary. So allegedly, they still wanted to protect their identities. Though in one of those newspaper articles, there's a picture of Rosemary, and she's basically just sort of wearing a Zorro mask, a domino mask. And there's biographical details like they moved here from England with two children. Like, if you knew them, you would know immediately who they were. But by being in newspapers, interested parties could probably send a letter to the newspaper, who would probably then forward it to Ray and Rosemary. So it was a good publicity sort of thing. Though Ray and Rosemary did not initiate too many people. I think over their course of their coven from 64 to 72, they initiated 35 people, which to some people was too many, and to other people, it wasn't enough. So it's really fun to read witchcraft books of that period. And somebody's like, wow, they're such snobs. They only initiated 35 people. And then the next thing would be, I can't believe that they initiated so many people, right? So you couldn't win no matter what you did. But, and then after that, they begin to do newspaper, they begin to do radio and some television, like in the New York City area. And one of the things about being witches and about being public witches, what you hope to do is get people interested in it from other places in the country. So, their hope is that somebody from a different state will come in and be initiated, and then they'll take that witchcraft to a different place. And so they did initiate some Canadians, and they initiated a couple in Kentucky who ended up, initiating a lot of people. And then they initiated a couple in California too. So, they were trying to spread this around, and it was really slow because America's a huge place and there's not instantaneous communication at this particular period of time by any means. And, it's a lot of work to find a witch and then get initiated.
So when did he begin writing, publishing, I should say, when did he begin publishing about witchcraft?
1966, and they're doing ritual in their basement a lot, and he builds some shelves down there, and he builds these shelves to heart to collect his witchcraft collection. Some of it is the Wilsons had given him some things that were of historical value. So he starts a small witchcraft museum in his basement. And this is the time too, he's still saying that he's not a public witch. And I'm like, come on. You talk about letting the Boy Scouts into your witchcraft museum in your basement. By this point, whether you wanted to be a public witch or not, you are a public witch. But because of that museum, he printed up a small pamphlet called Witchcraft, the Religion, which he always called his first book. And then by 69, he really started writing books for real publishers. But, 1966 is sort of the beginning of his writing career. And a lot of the early books that he wrote were things like This is the Occult. They're more like overviews of various practices. And when he writes about witchcraft, he's really just sort of regurgitating the things that Gerald Gardner wrote about, mostly history, not a whole lot of ritual. These are not 101 books or how-to books. These are about, yeah, witches are here in the United States, but good luck. Maybe you'll find one. This is not a good place to start.
So my understanding, though, is that the main—I don't know if I want to say the main—but one of the early influential books is *The Tree*,
Yeah.
because that's the one. And I think you mentioned it already, but that's the one where he kind of allowed for dedication, so that opens the door to solitary practitioners. But that also was that also, or was it in a different book where he brought in the sort of the law of three, or the threefold law.
So the threefold law is what you do, whatever you do in this life comes back to you in this life three times. So if you do good, it comes back to you three times in this life. You don't have to wait for the next life. And it's an idea that he really began articulating in the late 60s in magazines. So you would see it in any interview that he did. It was really good PR, right? Witches aren't going to do bad things because if we did, we would be in big trouble. And then in 1970, he publishes a book called Witchcraft from the Inside, which is his first witchcraft book for Llewellyn. Again, there's not a lot of doing witchcraft in the book, but the threefold laws in that book. And then it just kind of goes everywhere after that. But that's a gift of Buckland's to the greater witchcraft world for sure. And 74, that's The Tree. That's Buckland's first book of rituals. Right, if you want to do a Sabbat ritual, if you want to celebrate Lammas or Lunasa, like on August 1st or 2nd, depending on what your tradition is, here is a ritual for you. If you want to be dedicated into witchcraft, here is a ritual for you. If you want to do an initiation with a group of people, here is a ritual for you. And it wasn't necessarily the first book of its kind. By 1970, you have Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft, which had a lot of practical how to do witchcraft things in there. And then in 1971, you had Lady Sheba's Book of Shadows, which was a book like a witchcraft book from England. A Book of Shadows is a personal witch's ritual and spell book. And she'd been given one by a coven in England after she was initiated over the phone. Can't make some of these things up. And as soon as she got it, she put it in an envelope and sent it to Llewellyn to publish. So in 1971, you have like your first Wiccan witch rituals being published in a way that's accessible to people. So Ray was a couple of years behind the times, but one of the things that Ray did, he didn't violate any oaths. So like Lady Sheba sending that book to a publisher is a direct violation of this promise that she made when she got it, that she wouldn't do that. So Ray made up an entirely new tradition, something that people are still doing today. People make up traditions all the time, and they're n not any less valid than one that's been around for 50, 60, 70 years. The CX Wicca never quite really caught on. There are still people who practice it today, but Ray populated his tradition with weird words and new terms, and they never really caught on in the greater witchcraft world. So when you're reading the tree, you have to stop and think, like, what is it? What is a Gersith or something, right? Because it's so different from anything else.
Now, I may be mistaken, but and maybe you just said this, so excuse me. It takes a while for the coffee to circulate. But one of the other things that he did, there's the celebrations of the Sabbaths, the equinoxes and the solstices, and he brought in things like in bulk and whatnot. And was that his contribution? Because if I remember right, the gardener didn't really have all of that.
The names of the Wiccan Sabbats were in flux for a couple of decades. People, if you were a gardenarian, you didn't call Beltane May 1st Beltane. You called it May Eve and celebrated the night before because, the Celts started their days at sunset. So there was a lot of that. Like if you were celebrating what today we would call Lammas or Lunasa, that was August Eve. So the names really weren't set. They kind of began to slowly adopt the Irish Celtic names, things like Beltane, Lunasa, Samhain, and Imbolc over time. But Ray was one of the first to really do it in a book. Like if you go back through and you read Lady Sheba, she puts Samhain on the autumn equinox. Nobody today associates Samhain with September 20th. Right? That's clearly October 31st. And Ray laid it all out using these particular terms, and he was one of the first to do so in a printed book. So I can't say that he started the trend, but having them in the tree certainly accelerated the trend. And really, by the end of the 70s, those were pretty much the terms everybody in the greater pagan Wiccan community was using for the Sabbats. It's really fascinating to sort of watch the evolution of the names of holidays, and people always just assume that we've been using the same names at least since the 1950s, and that just really wasn't the case. There was a lot of differences. Gardner uses like February Eve, and then another book he uses Candlemas because I think he's starting to realize that, wow, probably need better names, but he's not particularly good at picking the names. So instead of picking Imbolc, he picks Candlemas, which is a Catholic holiday instead. So yeah, Buckland added to the richness and lore of the Sabbats and helped to codify what we call a lot of these days.
One of the other things that I think should be attributed to him is the changing views of allowing the LGBTQ community
Yes.
into witchcraft. And I wanted to specifically point that out because originally they didn't seem to be all that welcomed.
No, they did not. Gardner has said many homophobic things in the 50s and 60s. One of his high priestesses, her name's Lois Bourne, wrote that he was intensely homophobic in one of her memoirs. I've had people try to explain this away as it was still illegal to be gay in the UK, so you didn't want to associate that with the tradition that you were doing. I do know that one of the early initiates into Gardner's Bricket Wood Coven was a gay man, but how much he let Gardner know that, I don't know, right? So that's hard to say. But in the 1970s, you slowly have this movement where people are becoming less homophobic and much more welcoming of the LGBTQ plus community into the craft. And we say LGBTQ plus, but at the time it was probably really only lesbian, gay, bisexual, because nobody was thinking that far ahead. Right. I mean, this was still very, very early, but there were a lot of gay men who were active in the craft in New York City area in the late 60s, the early 70s. Leo Martello, Eddie Buzzinski, and Herman Slater. And those men were friends of Raymond Buckland. And I think that helped to change his thinking on some things. One of his earliest initiates was a gay man, one of the first two people he initiated into the Gardnerian coven that he had started with Rosemary. But also, if you read a lot of early witchcraft books, it's like, yeah, you could be gay and join the witchcraft community, but like, why would you want to? Right? It's not a very open and accepting way of speaking to people. And I think by the early 1970s, while Ray is active with all of these different people, he's beginning to see that, yeah, this is all right. And there's a couple of mentions of it in the tree, and then there's more mentions in it in the Big Blue Book. And the language by our standards today is not as welcoming and as inclusive as we would probably like. But for its time, that was a pretty big deal because there was still a lot of homophobia, especially in the initiatory traditions.
Well, it's just interesting to me because now, I mean, speaking in, the year 2025, Wicca and witchcraft seem to be very open to it and one of the most open and embracing traditions. And it seems to me, I think that there's this idea of the shared otherness in a way, the shared, we're kind of different that attracts people and welcomes people in. And so did Ray feel, do you know, or do you have a sense of, and this is kind of a larger question than just the homosexuality, bringing those in, welcoming gay people into the community. What was his sense of his relationship with kind of the larger culture in the sense of being kind of an outsider talking about witchcraft, especially in the United States at that time, because we started seeing this kind of radical rise of Christianity after World War II, and it hit its pinnacle at the election of Ronald Reagan.
I think Ray always saw himself as an ambassador for witchcraft. And remember, to him, witchcraft was very much a religion, and he wanted it treated seriously as a religion. There are a couple of things. He has an unpublished memoir, which helped me write this book. And there are a couple of moments in the memoir where he makes fun of people who don't dress like average everyday people, right? He thought, as a public spokesperson for witchcraft, that he should wear a suit to interviews and he should try to present himself as mainstream as possible because that's what he wanted. He wanted a seat at the table for witchcraft. The problem is, though, is like once you identify as a witch, I don't care how well you dress, how stylish your suit is. No one's looking at it. All they're hearing is the word witch, right? So by the 1980s, he did run into some trouble in places. He had a couple of speeches that were canceled. This was the era of satanic panic. And having a witch speak at a YMCA, oh, how terrible, right? Like they're corrupting the children. And that was a big change from the late 60s through the mid to late 70s, where the occult was kind of in vogue, right? You could go on Tom Snyder's Tomorrow Show, on go on Dick Cavett, and people were just sort of enchanted by you, right? Oh, you're a witch. Tell me what's that like? Which is really different from in the mid 80s going on Sally Jesse Raphael and being yelled at by the audience because they think that you're a Satan worshiper or something. So he got to live like sort of both sides of that. I think I like didn't really answer your question and I like answered nine other questions instead. But
No, actually, that does answer the question because
yeah.
it was really just in relationship to the larger culture. How did he relate to it? How did he present himself and witchcraft, Wicca? And so I think you did answer the question. And it was, I may have actually even seen him on that Sally Jesse Raphael show.
Yeah,
I
you
don't
can watch it
recall.
on YouTube. I think it's all there. And if you're a witch, Scott Cunningham is also on that show, and Selena Fox of Circle Sanctuary. But it's really fascinating to see these figures that a lot of us have grown up with. Authors from their books and things, and a lot of times too, they're frozen in time because you see that picture from 1990 or 85 or whatever, and there he is, right there getting yelled at by people in St. Louis, Missouri.
Well, I'll tell you what, I do have another question I want to get to, but I found it fascinating that you noted that in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, you said it remains a hotbed for Gardnerian witchcraft. And
Yes.
that's like one of the last places that I would expect to find a explosion of witches.
As someone who goes to at least 10 witchcraft events throughout any year, I will say that there are more witches in the American South and the Midwest than there are on the coasts.
Wow.
I think that there are more witches in places where civil rights are being violated, where you truly feel like an outsider, and that's could be parts of the South and the Midwest. They have like really active festival scenes in those places, a lot of witchcraft meetups and public pagan pride days. It's crazy to me. And people think of witchcraft as something, especially on the coasts, right? Oh, California must be a hotbed of witchcraft. No, I think that there are more witches in Georgia at this point, right? Because you need the empowerment that witchcraft gives you, especially if you're a part of a marginalized community. So people are attracted to the craft to take control of their own life. And the place where you have the least amount of control over your own life is sometimes places like the American South and the American Midwest.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. And, I can just say that, a lot of times our stereotypes are, I mean, most of the time our stereotypes are just dead wrong. I remember I moved to California like 21 years ago. I left a while back, but when I moved there, I had it in my head that I wouldn't be able to throw a stick without like hitting a metaphysical bookstore, And they're few and far between, very few and far between. I can name two. Well, and one's got a couple of locations, but I can name two in the Los Angeles area. And I think there I went to one up in Oakland when I was doing my doctoral program.
Ancient ways, probably.
Yeah, I think that was it.
I mean, I live in the Bay Area, California, and I thought the area would just be crawling with witches and pagans, lots of opportunities. And there are still a lot of witches and pagans here, but it's very spread out. It's hard to get around in. I also think like the high rents of California make witch shops really difficult. And especially where I live in Silicon Valley, a lot of engineers, and they just don't seem interested in witchcraft. Right, it's not that weird vibe you associate with San Francisco and the Haight-Ashbury and stuff. That's a lot of that's been pushed away.
Yeah, there's not even one of those shops in the Haight-Ashbury area. I mean, there are some bookshops, but nothing like that. Yeah, it's fascinating how our stereotypes can be disintegrated. One of the other questions I wanted to ask you is you've already mentioned Llewellyn, and it seems to me, and Llewellyn is the publisher of your book, and Llewellyn's a great publisher. I've worked with them several times, spoke to a number of their authors. But it seems to me that there is this very intimate connection between Buckland's writings, and I know he published with a few other publishers, but there seems to be this marriage of sorts between Buckland and Llewellyn. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about his relationship with Llewellyn Publishing.
He had a really close relationship with Carl Weschke, who was the owner of Llewellyn. He didn't found the company. He bought it after it had been around for several decades, but he turned it into what it is today and started printing witchcraft books. And Ray was one of the first witchcraft, probably the first witchcraft book they had ever published. That was 1970s Witchcraft from the Inside. A couple of months later, he follows that up with the book Practical Candle Burning Rituals, which, talking to Sandra Weschke while I was researching the book, that's Carl's widow, she said that book kept the lights on in the 70s. So it was really successful, and Ray had his greatest successes with Llewellyn. The tree came out with Samuel Weiser. So, as I said, not, as you said, he didn't just exclusively publish with Llewellyn, but he had a really good relationship with that publisher, and especially because he and Carl were friends. And I've got to read some of their correspondence, and Ray's living in San Diego. Llewellyn is based in Minnesota. Rey's always like, you should move here. You should move your whole operation here. It's 70 today. I heard that it was 2 in Minnesota today, right? So there's a friendliness to it, right? And even today, the vast majority of Rey's books that are in print that are not, self-published print on demand kind of things, they're still at Llewellyn. I don't want to say coddled Rey because that seems to be like maybe an exaggeration, but there was a high priority with Rey. He was one of their most famous, most profitable, most bankable authors, and they worked really hard to stay in his good graces. And when he would get a book rejected by Llewellyn, there was a lot of apologies when the rejection happened.
Okay.
And even today, there's a picture of Rey, Scott Cunningham, and Carl Weschke that Llewellyn uses a lot. And if you go into Llewellyn's offices in Woodbury, Minnesota, that picture is like framed and in a very, very prominent place. He was a part of the architecture at Llewellyn, he and Scott Cunningham especially, and just had good relationships with people who worked there.
So let's chat a little bit about the Big Blue Book and
All
what
right.
it is and why is it important.
So the Big Blue Book was not the first complete how to do witchcraft books. There have been a couple before that. 1979's The Spiral Dance by Starhawk, a couple of books by Janet and Stuart Farrar, What Witches Do and 8 Sabbats for Witches, which were collected in the 90s in the US and called A Witch's Bible. But there had not been a book that was really about what we call British traditional witchcraft or British traditional Wicca, things in the style of Gerald Gardner, that was really complete. And Rey saw an opportunity there. The Big Blue Book really evolved out of a study course that Rey started in the late 70s for his CX Wicca tradition. But he got tired of grading papers and signing people up for classes and didn't want to waste the material. So he reconfigures the material to take out the CX Wicca specific components and replace them with things that are more generic, that are more in sort of the general Wiccan witchcraft world. And he sends it to Llewellyn. And Llewellyn, Carl Weschke made the final decisions, but he would invite thoughts from others. And so he sends out Buckland's version of this book, and everybody else at Llewellyn hates the book except for Carl. And I got to find some great production notes like, this book will make Wiccans mad. This is nothing more than his rehash of his CX Wicca course. Boring, just really negative. And Llewellyn didn't want me to print that stuff, but I thought it was fascinating and fun to print. One of the things about the Big Blue Book is it is really thorough in its way, and it's thorough sometimes in ways that I find ridiculous. So an athame or an athame or an athame, depending on where you live in the world, is a knife that witches use in ritual. And most people would just go to the store to buy a knife, right? That's beyond most of us. Maybe if you're really like interested in making your own stuff, you might find a blacksmith to work with. Rey suggests like putting a piece of iron on your burner of your stove and then waiting until it's red hot and then pounding it into the shape of a knife. To me, that just seems like a fire hazard, but that is the Big Blue Book. I mean, it is full of everything, and not all of it's necessarily in depth, but you are exposed to just about every sort of magical thing and about every sort of Wiccan witch concept and idea under the sun. There are parts of it that I don't think have aged particularly well, especially the rituals, which I don't think are particularly very good, but they're still there and you can do them. When I have had my coven do them, they give me bewildered looks like, why are we doing this? But, they're still there. So no one had ever really seen a book like that before. And the layout of the book, too, it looks like a workbook. It's like, oh, I'm back in the fifth grade. Teachers handed out workbooks, but this one is on witchcraft, and I get to do it myself. No one had ever seen anything like it. Every chapter ends with study questions, and not every witchcraft book ends with study questions, but a lot of books after that, in its wake, they would have things like that, or encourage you to keep a journal and make notes while you're reading the book. And I think a lot of that comes from the legacy of the Big Blue Book. And as I said before, it's super recognizable. This is a story that I have about it involving my wife. So, very Catholic family, sitting in the living room with her stepfather and her mom, and they're watching Cops on TV. And cops raid a house, and there's a bunch of occult books everywhere. And one of them is the Big Blue Book. And her stepdad's like, "Oh, there's a satanic book." My wife had just checked that out of the library. It was upstairs in her bedroom. She slips out of the living room, goes into her bedroom, and hides the book so that they don't find it. And, it's just that iconic that it can be recognized on Cops.
And it still sells quite a bit, if I understand correctly. It's
It
probably
does.
one
It's
of
sold.
the,
It has sold over 500,000 copies. I think it's probably sold 600,000 copies. And if you go to a place like Salem, you go into some bookstores and there are still like shelves of the Big Blue Book, even though it was published in 1986 and has not really changed since 1986. There's a lot more contemporary things that probably better reflect where witchcraft is at this particular moment in time, but there are a few books as iconic as that book. And I think it's that size of the book and it's the workbook layout that just really appeals to people. But it's still like the book that's in every bookstore that has witchcraft books.
It is. It is. I always see it there. One of the other things that you mentioned already, and it is a current that runs through the book, and it is his witchcraft museum. And the museum now is, it's in Ohio, right?
Yeah, it's in Cleveland, Ohio. If you're watching this on YouTube, this is a t-shirt from the Buckland Museum. So the museum under Ray did not last particularly long. So he starts it in his basement in 66. In 71, he finds a place for the museum that is just the museum. And it's really only there for a couple of years before he moves to New Hampshire. He gets divorced in 72. There's a lot of things going on in his life, and he just wants to get away from Long Island. And so he takes the museum with him to New Hampshire, and New Hampshire's not good for Ray. He doesn't like the winters, which he describes in his memoir as soul destroying, which is a turn of phrase I just like, soul destroying. And also in New Hampshire, because of the winters, the museum can only really be open 6 months out of the year. Imagine having a witchcraft museum and not being able to be open on Halloween, right? It feels like that's not good for your bottom line, and it wasn't. And after 5 years in New Hampshire, the museum goes into storage and just like is in storage units and barns for a very, very long time. Sometimes Ray would take bits of it out and show people things from the collection while he was doing a lecture or whatever. But for the most part, it stays in storage. In the mid 90s, he moves to Ohio, and now he has the museum collection in his basement, in his barn in Ohio, because he buys a farm. And so he's kind of with it again. And this is a boom time for witchcraft by the mid 90s. And so people are interested in the collection because he always talked about his museum in his books. Sometimes he talked about it like it was an ongoing concern, which is really an exaggeration for sure. But, he talked about it, and so people were aware of it. And then he kind of got some offers. Would you like to put the museum in Vegas? And then that kind of falls through. There's an offer to put the museum in the Dominican Republic, which would have been really fascinating. Ray loved voodoo, and would have loved to have the museum there because it would have been right next to Haiti, but that didn't pan out either. And eventually, the materials for the museum are bought by a couple in New Orleans who are going to open the museum in New Orleans. Rey goes down there a couple times, helps them finance the purchase, does some fundraisers for them. They never pay Rey all the money that they promised to pay Rey. So he sues them to get control of the collection again, which he does. And then he bequeaths the collection to Tony Rotunda, who he's been doing some witchcraft rituals with, and she helps him put the museum, like catalog things and kind of get it into some semblance of order. At the same time, there's this guy named Stephen Intermill in Cleveland, Ohio, who's the curator of the Christmas Story House. You'll shoot your eye out. He ran that, put together displays, had a huge interest in the occult, and began asking what happened to the Buckland Museum. And he emails Ray, who puts him in contact with Tony, and they decide that they're going to reopen this museum. And Ray got to see the museum reopen before he passed away in 2017. And the Buckland Museum is still in Cleveland. Like, changed locations once, but it changed locations only for the better. And it's a really great place. It's not a huge museum. Buckland's material was not really that extensive, but there's some cool things there if you're interested in witchcraft history. And Stephen is a museum professional, which I really appreciate, and it's become a depository for a lot of things from witch and pagan history. People who have magazines that they're going to throw away from the 70s or don't have people to give it to, after they pass, they send it to Stephen at the museum. So there's a treasure trove of historical materials there too. But it is this really fascinating story of this museum that exists in a basement and then a location and then New Hampshire and then this long dormant period where it might have gone to some cool places and then it doesn't. And then it ends up in Cleveland, which I don't want to say isn't a cool place. Cleveland's fine. Drew Carey says it rocks. I always have a good time when I go to the museum.
Well, I remember reading a news article when it opened. So it got national coverage when it opened up in Ohio. But I have to say, I grew up in Ohio. The winters aren't that much better probably than what they are in New Hampshire. I would also
No.
describe them as like soul destroying.
Right. I mean, probably a little bit better, but I lived in the Midwest too. It's not a cakewalk by any means, that's for sure.
No. So I know we're starting to run out of time here, but I was just at the end here. What would you like to add about Raymond Buckland that we haven't talked about that you think is important for people to know or understand? And I certainly don't want to go over absolutely everything in your book. I want to encourage people to read the book, especially, anyone who has an interest in the history of witchcraft in America. I think it's an incredible book for that alone. But what would you like to say about Raymond Buckland?
One of the things that I liked about Ray, as I read about Ray and I watched his life story unfold, is he always thought there was room for more and more people in the circle in witchcraft, right? That there was not, he didn't have a desire to push people out. He had a desire to welcome them in. First that starts with people who are not initiated into traditions, and then that extends to the LGBTQ plus community. And then there's this idea that I'm kind of extending this open arm of friendship to people who don't even like witchcraft by going on TV and trying to talk about the craft in a positive way. So I really appreciated that about Ray. And a lot of times too, as you get older, you often get more conservative, more rigid in your thinking. And Ray did the opposite. As he got older, his thinking got more expansive and he was open to more and more people and more ideas. And I think he really cared about witchcraft and wanted to see it grow and expand and include as many different people as possible. So I really loved that about Ray's legacy.
Do you have any idea of, because he passed away in 2017, if I remember correctly. And by that time, Wicca and witchcraft had become much larger than what it was when he started. Did he, in like his memoir or any of his writings, did he comment on that?
He was just excited about it. So there's a DVD that came out in the early 2000s. It's a redone, remastered version of a VHS tape that came out in 89, 90, originally called Witchcraft Yesterday and Today, and then the DVD is called Witchcraft Rebirth of the Old Religion, which is an even worse title. And in it, Ray does what he calls a Wicca update 2001, 2002, when this thing came out. And you can just see the joy on his face talking about how many new witches there were. And he's just in this little glade in his at his farm. There's a couple of trees there. It looks really nice and peaceful. And he's not working from a script. He's just sort of talking about where Wicca and witchcraft are at that period of time. And again, just the beaming of it, right? Like, I'm so excited that so many people care about this now. It's beyond my expectations of the 60s or the 1970s. And yeah, I mean, he never really wrote about what he did in witchcraft. Like, I'm trying to sum up my whole life, right? He never really got to do that. His memoir sort of stops about the time he gets to Ohio, and still there's like almost 30 years of his life at that point. But at that point too, he was also less active in the witchcraft world. He was more into the spiritualism things, running the farm, and he'd written a lot of books about witchcraft and just didn't see the need to write a whole lot more, especially during the mid-90s, which is a really fertile time for witchcraft. And I always thought it was really interesting that he didn't try to capitalize on his fame a little bit more. Like, if he had done, The Big Blue Book Part Two, probably would have been a huge seller. And yet, that was not something that he wanted to do at all.
It seems almost like he is, I don't know how I want to frame this, but not necessarily all that concerned about his legacy.
I think there's some truth to that. He just had a lot of interests too. And one of the things that gets lost, especially among witchcraft authors, is you think that, oh, all they do is witchcraft. All they do is witchcraft. And as you said, Ray had a lot of mundane jobs. And then when he became a full-time writer, he also worked on the farm. So that took up some of his time. Yeah, I kind of forgot where I was going with that.
Yeah,
But,
no.
it's. You don't get to do this full time
Yeah.
necessarily as a witchcraft author. And Ray had a love of jazz, and he loved music, and he loved performing. He was a ventriloquist when he was young. Thankfully, he stopped doing that. That would have been pretty terrible. By the end of his life, he was doing stand-up comedy again, and you can see that on YouTube. A lot of dad jokes, probably a lot of groans from younger listeners, but still kind of pretty funny. He loved cars. He loved experimental aircraft. He had all of these different tradi like all these different interests. And depending on when you talk to him and what he was doing, witchcraft might rank five on the list. Maybe on that day, flying the one man experimental small airplanes that he liked to fly in San Diego might be number one.
Well, we're all multifaceted beings.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that sometimes with historical figures. And it seems to me that he will go down in history for his role in the propagation, the spread of witchcraft in the United States.
Absolutely. And one of the things that kind of makes me sad about the book is I was originally supposed to go to Lilydale and interview a bunch of people. Lilydale's a spiritualist community in Western New York where Ray did readings for people as a spirit medium, and he loved that community. I got COVID like right before I was supposed to go, and so I never got to do as much research there as I wanted to. But I think that could fill 10,000 words, make this book even longer than it already is. But the book's called High Priest, and I think what he's going to be remembered for is witchcraft. People are still going to talk about the Big Blue Book in 50 years. There are still a lot of Gardnerians, and they can almost all in the United States trace their history back to Raymond and Rosemary Buckland. So yeah, I think he's going to be a part of the witchcraft world for decades, even hundreds of years to come. As long as there are witches, there will be people who mention Raymond Buckland.
Yeah, I think so too. So, Jason, let me ask you, as we are at the end here, what do you have coming up next? What are you working on?
I'm working on a book called The Great Goddess of the Witches, which is about the goddess of the witches and about some individual witches that people kind of associate with that bigger idea of a goddess. It's sort of a sequel to a book that I wrote called The Horned God of the Witches that came out in 2021.
Okay. All right. And where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
I am one of four Jason Mankeys in the United States. So if you Google search me, I always end up first, much probably to the chagrin of the Indiana pastor who shares my name. But on all the major social media networks, I am at Pan Mankey,
Okay.
PanMankey.
All right. I will put some links to those in the show notes in the video description, as well as links to your book, High Priest, Raymond Buckland, the Father of American Witchcraft. So I thank you for your time. I enjoyed this conversation. I really enjoyed the book. And it was really fun to get to know Ray a little bit because, he was just this name and
Right.
this sort of authoritative name, Buckland, Buckland's Guide to Witchcraft and whatnot.
I'd only
So it
met
was,
him once,
yeah.
and very briefly. So to me, writing this book was the same experience.
Yeah.
I got to know Ray, and I didn't know him before.
Yeah. When it came across that, he's a well fleshed out character in the book and with, just like the rest of us with some flaws, but someone who led a very interesting life and had a significant role in religion in the West.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, Jason, again, thank you for your time. I appreciate it, and I look forward to what you do next.
Thanks, Nick. This has been great.
And that's a wrap on episode 210 of Verbal Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I have over 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 13 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I do love it, but it's a lot of labor. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscribers and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also purchase a Super Thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.